Hey, Leo.
Hello again, Stephen.
I had a great interaction at my hippie grocery store this morning that I wanted to tell you about.
I'm not sure that's possible, but let's give it a go.
So I'm standing in line, and a guy pays for his food, and he pulls out all these bills from his wallet. He hands them to the cash register, who is a woman, and he says, "Don't worry about giving me the change." And then he points to the change jar, and he says, "Just put it in your hoo-ha." Oh. Now, I know he was pointing at the change jar. She knew he was pointing at the change jar, but to watch her face try to figure out that he didn't know what hoo-ha meant.
I stand corrected. That was, in fact, a great exchange at the hippie market. Yes.
I'm just grateful she didn't take him up on it, because I would have been in line for a while.
Can you imagine? She's going to prop herself up on the counter and go ahead, mister. There you go. Spread her legs.
Yeah, right. Just cut to the counter and like her legs spread eagle. And
you, that's it, exactly.
And you hear the sound of quarters going into a gumball machine.
Exact change, please.
Just take that change and put it in your hoo-ha. And he was so proud of himself, too, like he was the nicest guy on earth.
Good deeds never go unpunished. Isn't that the phrase?
Oh, there, yes, exactly. All right, everybody, welcome to Spoils of Horror. My name is Stephen.
I am Leo.
And this is episode number 122, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, part one.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
This is our third visit to the Frankenstein franchise. Why did we make that happen?
When we were debating what we wanted to do for our two-parter episodes, I thought of a lot of different things. I thought of doing Terrifier 2. I thought of doing The Devil's Rejects. But I was really feeling like a period piece. And that matched really well with The Silence of the Lambs, because they were different. And you and I really love doing different stuff. And I remember really loving this movie when I was a kid. So I thought, this would be great. Let's cover this. It'll be a period piece. It'll allow us to revisit Frankenstein, but in a very different way that is not the Universal Monsters, that goes more back to the text. And then I had a very fun surprise. I popped it on and watched it and found out it was awful.
Oh, how times change.
This is not going to be a love fest, folks. I cried all the way through this movie. It was so bad.
I'm actually kind of glad to hear that, so we're not going to be opposing each other too very much during this.
I normally would not reveal what I feel about a movie right up front, but I knew Leo was going to think that I loved this and that he hated it. It was going to be one of those episodes. Not at all.
Which I was ready for, but this will be a lot more entertaining.
This movie is laughably bad. This is Howling 2 level, like laughably bad.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a conversation. You want to do it?
Let's do it. In 1794, Captain Robert Walton is sailing to the North Pole. He's obsessed with the glory of making the remarkable journey and is willing to risk the lives of his crew to achieve it. A horrible storm causes the ship to crash into an iceberg and become stranded in the Arctic Sea. Soon after, they hear cries in the distance. It's a man named Victor Frankenstein, sledding across the ice. He tells them to grab weapons and follow him into the snowstorm, but when something kills their hunting dogs, everyone hides below deck. Victor asks the captain to reconsider his foolhardy journey to the North Pole and shares his own tale of hubris in the name of achievement. His story begins in 1773 at a large estate in Geneva. We learn about the early life of Victor Frankenstein as he becomes dedicated to his studies, watches his mother die giving birth to his brother William, and in the movie's most horrifying moment, begins to fall in love with his own sister Elizabeth.
This is actually my first time watching this movie. This is back when they were trying to do... Every so many years, they do a revival of the Universal Monsters, trying to get them back in the silver screen again. They did Bram Stoker's Dracula, then went to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Then they did the Brandon Fraser Mummy. None of it really landed as strong as they wanted it to, I guess. But this film, I struggled to get through the viewings on this one. I really did. And it's a shame because it's got such a great cast and it's got such a great premise. And everybody universally agrees it's the closest adaptation of the book out there on screen. So it had all the right pieces to be a great film, then chose not to be a great film, including up to the point of, here's your adopted sister, fall in love with her.
I love the scene where the adopted sister is revealed to the story because it shows Victor at his house in Geneva and he's dancing with his mother and he's doing all this Victorian stuff that like you and I don't understand, like dancing to the piano with our moms.
Harpsichord.
Harpsichord. My apologies, Leo. My apologies. I like to think in your like piss poor home, you had a harpsichord and that's why you know what it is.
I know what it is because I'm a weird goth kid. That's all.
They're all dancing around and in comes, you know, the great Ian Holm, as people will remember as Bilbo from Lord of the Rings, or just nerds like me. He comes in and he's like, oh, well, like I've got this little girl here and her parents died and we're taking her in. And it is the most hilarious sort of like street urchin look.
Like, oh, yeah.
Like street urchin chic.
she could not have been more stereotyped and therefore more opposite of Victor.
Yes.
In this moment.
Everything except for twigs in her hair.
And exactly. Here's this child we found in the forest.
Right. I don't know if Ian Holm, because his character is a doctor, like often takes home children when their parents die. I don't know if there's some sort of, you know, like various rooms in this giant house where they have all these children that he's taken home. I don't know what it was about this kid that he's like, this is the person that we're going to take home because her parents died of scarlet fever and we're going to take care of her because she's an orphan now.
So I might have missed this in the relationship of everyone. Was he just this town's doctor? Did he live at this place? Or was he just dropping the kid off? Like, you don't have a choice. Here's this kid. There you go.
Ian Holm is Victor's dad, which shows you okay. How poorly this story is put together. That Leo just was unaware.
I literally did the thing where I watched this three times and I never quite understood who this guy was to the story.
I want to take it back a little bit because I don't want to just shit on this movie and I do want to talk about some of the things that I like. And one of the things I've always liked in the Frankenstein story, there are things that I'm going to compliment in this story that might just be stuff that you would say, well, that's the book that's doing it. But regardless, the movie is also performing it. And I've said before, we don't really take the book into consideration when we talk about a movie.
I will make the exception to that in this one a little bit, just because they went so far out of the way to be as faithful to the book as possible. So I think they mixed together.
To be fair, the story of Elizabeth being his sister is from the book. That is in
True.
There. But the shipwreck in the beginning, I've always liked the wraparound story in Frankenstein, and I've always been a little sad when they don't include it, because I think it is a really powerful part of the story. And I think it really zones in on the message, which is that the problem is not Victor's scientific advancement. It's his hubris, which I've said before, I don't like it when a story says that advancing in science is the problem. I said the same thing with The Fly. Yep. I like it when it's their hubris that's the problem. And you've got this captain that is hell-bent on getting to the North Pole, regardless of whether or not it kills his crew. And I like that they use this story to complement what's happening with Victor. And I think that you probably respond to this well. Just a lot of great old school filmmaking in that early section of the movie with the boat and the iceberg. All that stuff looks fantastic.
It was a lot of Captain Ahab in the way he was just, I've got to get there. I've got to get there. I'm going to get this whale, as it were. And I appreciated that for what you're saying, the old school storytelling aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I've also read the Frankenstein novel. And this scene with the sea captain always, for me, landed well, if you'll pardon the pun, because his obsession with getting to the North Pole and Victor's obsession with creating life are very much the same obsession. And the two of them meeting together and even in brevity sharing these obsessions with one another and recognizing that sort of madness in one another, I thought was a nice touch that, to your point, a lot of other Frankenstein films don't bother to cover.
And there's just a lot of cool, like, nuts and bolts filmmaking here, too. Great models and miniatures used for the ship.
Oh, yeah.
An old school set. And I especially like when the ship has crashed into the iceberg and it's covered with frost and snow and they're having to try to cut it loose. I really appreciate the old school work that was done in that set. And I was so jealous of those actors getting to work on that. It must have been really, really cool to work on a soundstage like that.
And that is something I will compliment now in hopes that it will carry throughout the film as I talk about other things. The fact that they were using practical effects in here, it was 94, so the digital effects they had were in their beginning stages of what we have now. Not as great as we would today, but even then, they were leaning more towards digital than practical.
Right.
Just because it was cheaper and easier. So the fact that they went so far out of the way to build so many sets and to make so many practical things happen, and even the appliances they put on for the creature, fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
Really well done.
Yeah. And you say that about the CGI effects, because there are a few in this movie and they look god awful. And one is in this section because they're trying to avoid the iceberg as the rain and is coming into the ship and the waves are crashing over and the beams are falling, which all looks incredible. And then the captain says, "Oh my God, iceberg ahead." And he says something like, "Right, hard to starboard." I think it's something like that, but it's basically take a hard turn on the starboard bow is how I understand it.
Some nautical term. Yeah,
exactly. And then it cuts to this CGI image of the ship, like trying to turn. And it looks like, it looks like watching like a Chevrolet Spark trying to turn in a puddle. Like it looks, you can practically hear the tire screeching there.
I don't know if they superimposed some kid's bath toy on here to make this happen or what, but it was bad.
It looks terrible, but the rest of it looks great. It looks really fun. It must've been a really good time for those actors to work on that ship. You said something that I really like, which is that there are things that you hope will carry through the entirety of these two episodes. Mm. So I want to say something now that I think is like a major point throughout the film. And I'll be kind now because it will become more of an issue later. But this movie has a weird problem with how time passes.
It certainly does.
There's an important series of events that happens right at the beginning of the film. And it starts around the 8-minute and 45-second mark. This is how granular I got with this. This is where we begin to see Victor. I know. Just wait.
I just like it's you this time instead of me.
Yeah. So around that point is when Victor starts talking to his mother in his study. And they're talking about, you know, his learning to be a doctor, things like that.
Yeah.
It establishes the relationship with the mother, you know, all the things that we need to know. So then at the end of the 12-minute and 15-second mark, so we've talked for about 3 minutes. We've had 3 minutes of movie. Let me tell you everything that was established in 3 minutes. Victor is close with his mom. He studies too hard. He's in love with his sister, Elizabeth. He wants to become a doctor. Justine has a crush on him. Victor's mom dies in childbirth. Victor's mom gives birth to his brother, William. He also discovers the power of electricity, and we find out that Kenneth Branagh has the worst cry on the silver screen. All of that happens in 3 minutes.
You're not wrong. It's one of the major drawbacks I have to this movie. It's so rushed. I'm going to cover this more
it's
later.
It's so fast.
Normally, we talk about a film and its pacing and we're like, man, if you would just hit those beats a little stronger. This movie is like, fuck it. We're doing half of the novel in about 5 minutes. Go.
Yep.
And I'm like, what the shit just happened? And I couldn't keep up.
It wasn't until the third watch that I realized that Elizabeth and Victor were looking out the window while they were waiting for their, while they were mating. Oops.
Might have been.
Ding, 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 ding. While they were waiting for their mother to give birth upstairs, they're looking out the window. There's a storm happening and lightning strikes the tree outside. And it's a blink and you'll miss it moment. But I thought, okay, I get what just happened there. He's connecting the power of electricity with his mother's death.
Right.
That's great. I actually really like that. Mm-hmm. And so I could have totally forgiven this sequence and just had fun with it if it was the only one of its kind.
Mm.
But this is going to happen over and over and over again. I would have actually thought this was clever. I would have thought, wow, yeah, they did a great job telling so much backstory in 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. But this happens over and over and over again. And we are going to come back to this because it is going to get hilarious.
It's about as bad as you can get without literally watching the film and fast forward.
In order to really get a sense of how this plays out, when you find out that Victor understands the power of electricity, he's in love with his sister, he wants to become a doctor, his mom dies, it plays less like the opening of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and more like the recap of last week's episode of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Last time on Frankenstein.
Right. I want to become a doctor. Elizabeth, we're in love. William's going to be born. What happened to Mom? I don't know. Tune in this week for Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Who do you think wore it better for the electricity portion of this when they're playfully using static shock on each other? Him or Ben Franklin?
Oh, yes. There's a part where they sort of kind of get struck by lightning, and then they all stand up like they've become Electro from Spider-Man 2.
That's so dumb. It's so fucking dumb.
Sharks of the Corn, Virus Shark, Sharkenstein, Sharktopus. Yep, those are all real movies. Now on the Bucket of Chum podcast, I dive into the bizarre, funny, and occasionally fantastic shark film. So tune in every week as I sink my jaws into the deep blue sea. That is Sharksploitation Cinema on Bucket of Chum.
Three years later, Victor's driven by the passing of his mother to prevent death from happening to others. He moves to Germany and begins studying with a wide range of equally aggravated professors who find his strange theories about dying borderline on the occult. His only confidants are his new best friend, Henry Clerval, and the Dr. Walden, a mysterious professor also experimenting with life and death. They learn his theories, study his ideas, and see a demonstration in his lab. Using electricity, a severed hand is able to be reanimated and grip onto Henry. It's exceptionally strong. Victor becomes more and more driven to create life from death, but Walden is apprehensive, since his last experiment created an abomination. After the professor is killed while giving out smallpox vaccinations, Victor steals his notes to replicate the experiment. He scours London for the body parts of cholera victims and the amniotic fluid of birthing mothers. Combined with the brain of his former professor, he has all he needs to conduct his experiment.
I love when an actor who is known for a specific genre gets the opportunity to perform in a different genre and actually prove themselves as a well-rounded actor. And thus we see John Cleese in this role as, what was it, Malden?
Walden.
Was it Doctor's? Walden. Dr. Walden.
Malden is a town in Massachusetts.
It is that, yes. But Dr. Walden was portrayed very, very well, and he did it very straight, and he did it very serious, and he did a damn fucking good job of it. I'm fascinated by the idea that it seems like in every Frankenstein film, there's always a debate between Victor, or the character that is Victor, and the professors at these universities. And I would love it just once where a teacher was like, holy shit, that is a wild and fun idea. Let's fucking run with that and see what happens. And if anybody could have pulled that off, John Cleese could have.
Leo is just taking memories from his own past and wishing them on this movie.
I just wanted to see him come out like Basil Fawlty and start fucking around.
One thing I do like about this movie is I think it does a good job at fleshing out Victor a bit. Often Victor Frankenstein comes off as kind of a character you need to have in a better movie about the creature. And so the creature will be the more sympathetic character. It's not to say that Victor isn't played well in other movies. Mm. He's just not the character you sympathize with. And I think it's a blessing and a curse for this film that I end up sympathizing with him. I actually quite like him. And I find that while his hubris comes on display later, I think that his early excitement and joy with discovery is pretty infectious. It's one of the things that I think Kenneth Branagh plays well. Because quite frankly, I don't think Kenneth Branagh is all that great in this movie. But I do think that he plays that part well. I especially like it in the scene that you were describing where him and his family, they're all kind of like running around in the Alps of Geneva. They get struck by lightning in a way that, you know, makes sense. They don't actually get struck by lightning. It actually doesn't make sense at all. It's actually stupid. But anyway.
I was going to say, it's not like a James Otis thing and they get killed. It's just, you know, them fucking around while there's electricity in the air and one stagnant cartoon cloud that is just hanging over them for some fucking reason.
It's true.
That is no sense in science whatsoever.
But his feelings in that scene are very infectious. And I really do like that about this character. And so you talk about him going to college in Germany and him going and talking to all these professors. I actually think this is some of my favorite parts of the film. I really enjoy the beautiful set design. That classroom, there's this classroom that's almost like a cylinder. And the students, as opposed to being below the professor, are above him. And they're all watching from these like railings that are, you know, 2, 3, 4, or 5, you know, floors up. I thought that was really stunning looking. I thought that was really cool. And I really do enjoy that they allow this part of the movie to breathe a little bit and to let us get to know Victor's passion and his philosophies about life and death and how it's rubbing up against his professors the wrong way.
And I like what you said about it being sort of a double-edged sword with Victor, because I agree with you. His passion about it and the way that Branagh plays it and is able to get into that character, I think is admirable. I think he does a very fine job with it in that regard. I think it really is a disservice to him at times being the passionate one or being the one that we empathize with. And I don't know if that comes from, I'm just so accustomed to that role being assigned to the creature, or if it's just that I did not share what the audience was supposed to feel for him. I was looking at him as being kind of obnoxious and annoying through most of the movie, so that when these sympathetic moments came up, I was like, yeah, but you're also a twat, so who cares?
Absolutely, I get that. And look, there's a certain level of richness that this character has that's hard to identify with. You know, when you're watching him prepare to go to college, and he has like a grand ball that his father has set up for him, where everybody's wearing in white and they're all dancing in unison just so they could say goodbye to the kid that's going off to college. I mean, Jesus Christ, like, it's amazing my parents cooked hot dogs.
It reminded me of that scene in Omen 2 where Damien and his cousin get like a big envelope full of money and a huge party and all this other shit just because they're going off to military school. I'm like, go fuck yourself. What are we doing here?
My parents were throwing furniture out the windows of my room the day after I graduated high school. Like, let alone.
Oh, sure.
They couldn't wait to figure out what to do with my old bedroom.
I did not get the chance to go to college. My mother, before I graduated high school, like halfway into the year, was already talking about how excited she was to move the fuck out and have her own space and all the stuff she was going to do with it. And I'm an 18-year-old kid who hadn't even finished school yet, let alone made plans to leave. So I get it. Totally get it.
I want to stay on this party for a second because it cracked me up, because everybody's wearing white. They're all dancing in unison. And you think to yourself, this is a high school graduation party. Like, this is a lot of effort put in for this. It reminded me,
junior prom.
Have you ever seen that event that happens? It happens in Boston sometimes, those dinner en blanc events.
No.
Oh, dinner en blanc. It's a whole thing. I'll put something in the show notes. It's where you have seen these before because we've talked about them. It is, it's that it's a worldwide event where everybody will show up to the same location and they all wear white and they all bring tables and chairs. And
we have talked about this, yes.
And they bring all their own food, and they sit down and have dinner together. And for some reason, people absolutely adore this. I don't get it at all.
So basically, you're dressed in the easiest to stain outfit possible, bringing a picnic to a random location a bunch of other people are going to.
And exactly. And you look elegant when you're there, but when you're dragging your table and chairs away with a radio flyer wagon...
It's not exactly Mary Poppins, is it?
It's not the same vibe. I can't imagine the stress of having to dance in unison. I don't even like going to weddings because I'll fuck up the Macarena.
The only reason I can pull off dancing at all at this day and age is because I can go out there and just flail my arms and wiggle around and people think it's some sort of new age shit and I get away with it.
Leo,
if I had to be uniformed and not clumsy and get through it, it's never going to happen.
Leo, they're just impressed you got out of your chair. They're just that clapping for you. Good job.
I dance badly on purpose so that nobody asked me to do it twice. That's what it is.
I will say, though, I do love the final line in this section, though, because Ian Holm gets up on the staircase and he addresses everyone. He says, you know, my kid is going to university and going to study to be a doctor. And he gives Victor this gift from his wife who's passed away that is a journal. And he has a line that he says that I absolutely love. He says, this is the journal of Victor Frankenstein to be filled with the deeds of a noble life, which, of course, is ironic because that's not what's going to happen with the journal. It's going to be filled with the deeds of creating this creature. But I do really enjoy the line and enjoy the weight that it's given at the end of the scene.
I don't know how Victor would have felt in that moment. I know that I would have been like, oh, a book. Thanks.
Right.
You know, appreciate the party. That's great. I could have used a cash handout or something for my starting. It's okay. A book. A book is good.
What's he supposed to do? Give him a microwave? Like, give him.
He could have talked to his friends and got him stand up with a job or, you know, paid for an apartment. Kids are doing that now. Their parents are paying for apartments and cars and shit.
You know, now that I think of it, I was very grateful that the microwave that my parents gave me for college. So maybe that would have been better than a journal for all my noble deeds.
It sounds like a parent who's not necessarily overbearing, but sort of that passive aggressive overbearing. Like, here's this book for you to fill out all your noble deeds, Victor.
Right.
There you go. Wink, 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 wink. Right.
Leo, I want to see if you notice something. Like all good Victorian dramas, there's a lot of scenes where characters, you know, write letters to one another. They write a letter, they send the letter, and the person opens the letter and they read it and so on and so forth. Is it me or does everyone in this movie read out loud every time they write something and just talk to themselves constantly?
I think it's the state of the 1700s where you're so fucking bored, you have nothing better to do but walk into a room and openly exclaim your inner thoughts and anything that's written on a piece of paper.
I think that's problem number one with this movie is that every single time somebody sits down to write a letter, they're like, dear Victor, I went to the grocery store today and then I found out that tomatoes were on sale. So I bought some extra ones. Who the fuck are you talking to, Elizabeth?
I know. It's crazy. I don't mind the exposition of the letter transition thing in movies when, again, it's done well. I think sometimes, like, Victor could receive a letter and go, aha, I just learned from Elizabeth, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And now the movie progresses forward. We don't need the whole history of this, every fucking syllable on the letter written and read out.
Well, what most movies will do will have the character who wrote the letter do a voiceover.
Exactly.
That's what they'll do. And so, you know, Kenneth Branagh's character can open it up and it can be Helena Bonham Carter's character that she plays Elizabeth. And she's fine in the movie, but like she's fine with the material she has to work with, which is terrible. But
she's as good in this movie as is possible for her to be.
That is a perfect way of describing what she is able to do with this movie. But you can have her voiceover read the letter, but instead what they do is they show her writing the letter, reading it. Yeah. And then this happens over and over and over again. Like everybody reads everything. Everybody reads everything. The creature opens up the journal. He's like, the journal of Victor Frankenstein.
See Jane run. Right. Run, Jane, run.
And I think one of the problems with this movie is that there's just everybody here just comes from the theater and they don't get the fact that the theater stuff doesn't work in film. And so what happens is these characters will also just talk to themselves randomly.
Yes.
Victor stands out by his mother's grave and says, no one ever needs to die. Like, who the fuck are you talking to? You better have a fucking mouse in your pocket or somebody behind you.
His name is George.
The creature does it later in the movie, too, when he comes more in. There's a part where he screams, "I will have my revenge." I picture animated animals just looking at each other and being like, is he talking to you? Is he not talking to me?
I understand, as a weird example, just being a gamer, that sometimes you're going to shout at things that are inanimate. Or like if you stub your toe walking through a room and you're like, "Ah, fucking couch, screw you."
Right.
Something like that. I get that. So like I can forgive a few like anguished shouts to the ether from some of these people. But to your point, it's such a constant in this film.
Yeah.
That everyone is vocalizing outward. And it's exactly what you're talking about, where theater people or people who are making television who have a small studio set and they can't afford a long shot, so they have to announce what's happening in the other area. Oh, here they come walking up the driveway. I see Bill's with them. He's dressed to the nines. You can't show it on film, so they have to describe it. And it's all theater stuff. It's all theater tactics, which, again, to your point, does not work in film.
There's a part where Victor is breaking into a tomb because he's going to steal a body for his experiments. And he looks outward, like out into the distance, and he says, "Raw materials, that's all they are," meaning the bodies. And I thought, if he moved his eyes one quarter of an inch, he would be staring right into my soul. Like he would
That's right.
Like, who are you talking to?
Yeah, he's not even talking to his friend that he brought with him or whatever form of Igor is in this film. It's just him talking to the skull on the wall or some shit.
And when you mix that with just the fact that these characters will exclaim things to the heavens, it just comes off as ridiculous. There's a part where Professor Walden dies. We're getting there. And when he dies, Victor is screaming and crying and trying to bring him back to life. And he says, "It need not happen," as in, you know, death, which "it need not happen" is a good line in and of itself.
Sure.
But then he has to scream it looking up. "It need not happen."
Oh, so fucking overdramatic. God damn. While all of this is happening with Victor, there's also a cholera epidemic happening in town. I'm not going to spend the entire podcast comparing it to our recent times epidemic because, boy, the similarities are outrageously fascinating. But when it comes to Walden, John Cleese's character, he's actually doing more than just trying to help Victor with his insane fantasies. He's attempting to be a good person and give people vaccinations and things that'll help them, which, again, same old arguments as we've recently been through with the people refusing to get vaccinated or whatever. And through that, he ends up getting killed, which is a very heavy-handed approach to "fuck you, I don't want your mask on my face."
I agree with you completely. I think John Cleese probably gives the best performance in this movie, and it is kind of an unsung hero of this early part. I really like him in the movie. I really like his sense of mystery. I wish that there was a little bit more payoff with it, but I really do enjoy it. And again, I talk about the set design. The set design in this movie is incredible. I love his lab. I've talked about this before. I have kind of a soft spot for science labs in movies. When they reveal his, it's this great backdrop of poultices and potions and little gadgets and gears and different things like that. And actually, probably that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, is when Victor starts to get to know this professor and they form this friendship. And of course, we get to see that he is able to use electricity to reanimate a dead arm. I actually kind of like the explanation of using acupuncture to get electricity into the right parts of the body. It's very Jurassic Park-ish, where it's like, okay, we pulled the blood from a mosquito, and you know what? Like, that sounds good enough.
You don't really need much more when you're getting into something that's on the edge of science.
It sounds good enough to me, and I don't understand how any of these things work. So that sounds great. I buy it. But I am glad you brought that up, because I really do enjoy his performance and I really do enjoy the set design of his lab. Mm-hmm. It's just a little awkward, though, how it cuts to what's happening with the vaccinations, because I think this speaks to what doesn't work in this movie. Walden is talking to Victor and Walden says, you know, "We're not going to create life from death. It's immoral." He said, "When I did it, I created an abomination." And then it cuts directly to him giving vaccinations to people with smallpox. And so when that happens, you think that you're watching a flashback.
Yeah, exactly.
But then you're not, because you see Walden, he's fighting with somebody over vaccinations. The person pulls out a knife from nowhere, kills him, and then everything just erupts into madness, showing us the 1773 version of a Trump rally.
Accurate.
The only thing that was missing was a guy with Viking horns and blue paint on his face.
What is that? It wasn't blue paint, though. They were drinking silver, wasn't it? And
I'm sure. It's the silver that they got from the pizza chain where Hillary Clinton was holding children. I couldn't help but think of that same analogy of the masks and the vaccines and Trump when they take the criminal.
So crazy.
Who's played by Robert De Niro, because he's going to actually play the creature. But when they take him up to the gallows and he's hanged, he's like, "You're all criminals." And I thought, there are Trump supporters that are like, "That's the real hero of this movie."
For those who haven't seen the film, De Niro plays a guy who, if I remember right, did he refuse the vaccine or?
He refused the vaccine. He didn't get it. He didn't get the vaccine and then kill Walden.
Well, no. He refused it. He's like, "I don't want that shit in my arm," whatever else.
Yeah.
Killed Walden and they hung him for it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the bodies that Victor comes to claim for the creature. I really marvel at the idea. This film was made in 1994. So many years later, we would come up to COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying things in this movie that are exactly the same arguments that we had during COVID from one side or the other. And why I'm fascinated about that is because they would have had to gone through history textbooks or what Mary Shelley was writing at the time and realize that her writings had those same arguments back then. We don't change as a human society. We'd never, ever change. People are always going to be fucking stupid at one point or another.
Look, I just was really struck by the similarities, like whether or not somebody can choose to not have a vaccine because of their own bodily autonomy. I'll leave that for them to decide. But I did really enjoy the timeliness of this, and it just cracked me up because, of course, you have these arguments being made and they sound very similar. And it gets into all the drama, like everything is at an 11 in this film. Like everything is larger than life, but it also has to be as quick as humanly possible to be able to fit into the film. If montages were never invented, they could not make this movie.
That is a fair point. Absolutely. Jesus Christ.
When one of my favorites is when they are collecting the body parts for the creature. I really love this scene because it's just Victor walking into places and paying somebody and being like, "I'll take those bodies." And then he just takes the bodies or he just cuts them up. But my absolute favorite, the one that I just could not stop laughing about, is the amniotic fluid. So what it shows is a woman giving birth. She's in a chair. And then her water breaks, and it is just a fire hydrant of water that comes out of her vagina. But what's so funny is the woman collects it, and the shot never cuts. She just walks right behind her, hands it to Victor, and he hands her like a dollar, and he walks off with it.
It's crazy.
It's so fucking funny. Like, I don't know anything about this nurse. Maybe she really likes being a nurse, but she'd make a fucking great barista.
Spelled his name wrong on the side of the container.
I mean, that's really great service. She poured that and just turned it right around. "I've got a drink for Victor, one amniotic fluid with heavy foam."
Oh, I love that.
It's a venti. It's a venti amniotic fluid with heavy foam for Victor. It's just so funny how this movie works so hard to cut dead air and then inadvertently doesn't make any sense. Like the idea that Victor is just waiting, this army of women that are giving birth that are just shooting out amniotic fluid and they're just turning around and handing him buckets of it is just so unintentionally funny to me.
How many people are giving birth in this era? He had a fucking tank full of this shit, like huge monster body-sized tank of this fluid. You're right. The fire hydrant explosion of this woman was fucking hilarious. But I can't imagine that many women are producing that much fluid.
It must be like the ladies in Mad Max, where they all have their tits hooked up to the hoses so they can produce milk for the town.
Oh, it's fucking nuts, dude.
Can you imagine? I just want you to imagine that for a minute. Imagine like 10 women and they're all like doing their nails and reading books, and they all have tubes up to their vatches, and they're just getting pregnant and just dumping the water in.
It's like one of those sleep apnea masks just hooked up to their crotch.
Yep.
And just like... The baby's coming. Disconnect the hose.
Yeah. It looks like the tubes from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oompa Loompa Doo-ba-dee-doo. We've got amniotic fluid for you.
in a little river with a boat on it.
Jesus Christ. I don't know why people lose so much fluid in this movie. It's like the only thing they could do to make real horror happen. I don't know. Because there was the scene earlier when his mom died giving birth, and that doctor was ensconced in blood. Like, there's no wonder she died. Every ounce of blood in her body came out of her.
Look, and there's a lot of blood that comes out of birth. I know that can happen. You know, the baby was turned around the wrong way. But again, it's just everything is so heightened that it's hard to figure out what is real and what isn't, because everything is just on a scale of 25, you know, which should be a scale from 1 to 10. I should say, oh, it's at a 10. No, it's at a 25. Everything is just so huge. Like, every time that there's just, like, the peasants, and I'm saying peasants and I'm saying street urchins, not to make fun of poor people, but to make fun of the fake poor people in this movie. Because
they really, anything that, those two words create such a specific visual in your mind.
Right.
And that is exactly what these people look like.
Exactly. And again, it's too bad, because when you just look at it from a costume design or a set design perspective, the city looks amazing. You know, there's dead bodies everywhere. It's like I like that. It's like a decorating choice.
It's amazing.
It's beautiful. But
a summer home.
It's cool. Like, it gives you this idea of what a cholera epidemic probably looked like. And I do like the fact that the movie does a good job at taking these things that are in the background and putting them in the foreground. Cholera feels like a big part of the early part of this film, which in the book, it might be just a throwaway detail. Mm-hmm. So the movie does a good job at like beefing up these things that were maybe not a big deal in other versions. The cholera epidemic, Victor's studies, why he cares so much about what he's doing. It just hurts the larger arc of the movie.
Well, I think that touches back on something you'd mentioned earlier when you're talking about the transitions and how this thing with Walden looked like a flashback, but wasn't. And the movie does a lot of that. While they're speeding through everything so fast, while they're hurrying to get to where they're going, they're not doing the right transitions to give us a good sense of timing or how things are happening, in which order they're happening, or why scene A is important to scene C. It's skipping too many of the details as it's trying to progress too fast to the end.
Elizabeth arrives in London. With a cholera epidemic killing mass numbers of people and the possibility of martial law, she tries to get Victor to leave, but he's determined to stay and finish his work. Shortly after, it's time to run the experiment. Victor runs through the lab, flipping switches and pulling levers as his creation's body moves through a Rube Goldberg series of contraptions before being lowered into a pod of amniotic fluid. Needles are inserted at critical points, and electricity is charged through the corpse's body. Its eyes open. It's alive. Victor helps the creature stand and watches with pity as it struggles. He questions the morality of his actions before lying down and falling asleep. It's very important to him. He wakes to a loud noise. The creature stands nearby. It chases him through the lab before grabbing a jacket and escaping to the outside world. Little does he know, Victor's journal is inside the pocket.
You were talking about laboratories earlier and Walden's lab, which is very cool and very Harry Potter-esque. Then we get to Victor's lab, and it's an entirely different situation, which I do admire. I like that this film was able to take two different personalities and create the laboratory from that personality or that mind and differentiate between the two so distinctly. I think that's a really cool touch. I'm not sure about Victor having a giant butthole inflated on the ceiling, but I mean, any port in a storm, I guess.
His lab is very steampunky. You know,
it is that.
It's yes. got big parachutes that are filled with air or something, and chains and levers and switches and different batteries and different things like that. And I think it's really important to kind of isolate this part of the movie, because we've talked about the fact that we didn't like the time. We've talked about some of the drama in the film. We'll get more to that later. But this is the part where I think it really becomes clear why this movie just does not work. Because this scene where he brings the creature to life is one of the most unintentionally hilarious montages that we've covered on this show. It never didn't have me crying the whole time. So let me just spell this out for everybody, and then I'll let Leo fill in some of the details. You've just never seen the creature prepared in this way. Elizabeth has decided to leave him. She is upset with him that he is not willing to come back to Geneva while this, you know, cholera epidemic is coming on. I love when she walks into his place and she's like, this place is disgusting. And it looks like a mom walking into her son's room when he's just started masturbating. Like,
she's like, basically, I'm leaving Victor because he's too obsessed with his new life and his new friends, and I just don't have time for it.
It looks like she's just picking up porno magazines and finding the pages stuck together.
Why is your sock so crusty?
Yeah. This is disgusting, Victor. This is disgusting. So in the lab, first and foremost, the most dramatic, like swashbuckling sword and sorcery epic music comes on that is supposed to be for like Sean Connery as Robin Hood, like fighting the Sheriff of Nottingham, like on a staircase. That's what this music is supposed to be for.
It's like watching Master and Commander.
Oh, 100%. What a great, great example. It's supposed to be the kind of music where people are like jumping from barrels to fight bad guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is also kind of the tone here, because he's running through the lab and he's like pulling chains, but he's using the chain to pull up his own body to jump on a pod, to then jump off of the pod, to jump somewhere else. And it's all like a swashbuckling scene where he's just setting up the creature's body. And it's just so over dramatic.
I think it speaks to Victor going to school to learn anatomy, to learn medicine, to learn what he needs to do to make a body happen. He should have also minored in architecture and design.
Yeah.
This is the most inefficient fucking lab on earth. The fact that he's got to sprint halfway around to do things to get, oh, I put the on switch at the other side of the room. I got to get there before the fucking creature gets to the vat so I can lower him down. You could have made a much more streamlined lab that would have gotten the same goddamn job done.
I think that this movie is a really good case for not having to take general electives, because he is he is way too inspired by his acting 101 course. Because it's just so over the top. But the thing I haven't mentioned that makes this so fucking funny the entire time, it's not the music, it's not the staging, although those are funny too. It's that when he does the entire scene shirtless. And
yep.
And so
we have the Captain Kirk syndrome.
Yes. So what happens is Kenneth Branagh comes running around the corner to start the scene, and he's wearing a robe that's sort of straight out of Buffalo Bill's Goodbye Horses collection.
It really is.
He just tosses it into the corner, and with his big, giant, curly, like froofy Victorian hair, and the fact that he's wearing like black leather pants, he looks like Michael Flaherty from Riverdance.
I like to think that because Brannan actually directed the film as well, nobody had written a scene for him to be shirtless. He just decided that's how it was going to go.
If you've seen his Hamlet, I'm going to say he's a version of Hamlet that's very similar to this. That's very like a little too much. I like it, but it's a little too much.
He reminded me of those guys who they used to be dad bod and then they got fit and now everywhere they go, they're taking their shirt off just to show their chest. And
I thought that if the experiment didn't work, he was going to use the power of Irish step dance to bring the creature to life.
I am the Lord of the Dance.
I want you to imagine him standing on that pod and he's like, live, live, live. And then he just hooks the wires up to his feet and just starts tapping on the top.
Live, damn you. And dancing on his fucking
corpse. All the little electrical arcs start going into the pod. And there's fire and electricity like throughout the entire scene that's like blowing up behind him. It's so laughably bad. It is right up there with anything Stilba does in The Howling 2. Like that you can't imagine anybody thought this was a good idea.
And that's the thing. Somebody somewhere said, we need this to be cinematically huge. We have this outrageous budget to make this film happen.
Right.
We need this to be the biggest, loudest thing. And they did exactly that. And in doing so, took away from any seriousness of this moment.
Right.
I've seen a lot of Frankenstein movies. I've seen a lot of parodies of Frankenstein movies. I've seen even fucking Young Frankenstein, who borrowed the original lab to do the thing. It was still cinematic. It was still big, but it was still kind of serious to bring the thing in. Mm-hmm. And this is him, I suppose, trying to pay homage to the Boris Karloff one where, you know, instead of saying it's alive, he goes live and all that. But Jesus Christ, it was too much. It was too big.
Well, and when you talk about that line right there, it's not him standing on top of the pod going live, live, live. It's him slamming his fists on the pod, looking into a porthole in it, screaming live, 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 which I did identify with because that is exactly what I scream at my penis when I'm about to have sex.
Well, they have pills for that now, so you're doing all right.
Oh, I take those,
rub
too.
Rub a little cream there.
Oh, it's, well, they hook up the electrodes. They have those little electric bolts.
You just need one electric eel. Victor had 20. You just need one little one.
The eels are a part of this whole thing, too, because it's not just the drama. So there's these electric eels that are somehow worked into this whole, you know, system of this lab and how this is all going to work, and they're going to produce electricity. And so it's not just that you have electricity pumping into the pod with all the amniotic fluid, but it's also filled with electric eels that are biting onto the creature's body to also bring it to life. Jesus Christ, now why not have a fucking unicorn in the background? Like, what else do we need?
Exactly. The big butthole I was talking about earlier is to drain all the electric eels into the tank to...
Yep.
If that's the case, then why do you need the steampunk electricity that you're creating? You don't need both. It doesn't make any goddamn sense.
And that's the problem with this movie, is the tone. The tone is the problem. The tone of this movie, I figured it out, is if you took a deeply committed thespian whose main passion in life is to be the greatest actor in the world and bed beautiful women, then you provided him with $45 million for a budget for this movie, and you put him on methamphetamines. Like, that is the tone of this movie.
Yeah, I can't argue that. That's accurate. Also sounds like any drama club I've ever been in my life.
Yeah.
Minus the budget, of course.
Right. And not and about 50% of the time wanting to bed the women. Let's not be unreal here. But I knew actors like this who, like, their only drive in life was to be these Kenneth Branagh types, the greatest actors on earth. And it was that, and it was like getting laid a million times. And that was all that there was. And this movie kind of reeks of that.
I think reeks is exactly the right word.
Guys, we've been doing this thing for a while, and I think it's about time we make a trailer.
Yeah.
All right, so here we go. Let's get this thing. All right, ready? All right, what's going on, everybody? We are Dissect That Film. I am Brett.
I'm Dan.
I'm Angela.
And wait, guys. I have an even better idea. What if we had somebody with an epic voice sell our show in a way that our show actually isn't? What do you say?
Yeah.
Sounds perfect.
All right, let's go. Let it rip.
Your host, Parker, Dan, and Angela, slice and dice their way through the good.
If it bleeds, we can kill it.
The bad.
You brought the devil!
the devil inside everyone.
And the ugly movies you love.
And you can't piss on hospitality. I won't allow it.
Hold your favorite films and franchises tight, because they aren't safe. In fact, it's already too late. It's time to dissect that film.
I wish our show is what that guy just said. But you know what? If you want to listen to our awesome show, Dissect That Film, you can listen to us on YouTube and on your favorite podcast apps every single Friday, where we talk about all the wonderful films, good, bad, or ugly, as that epic dude said back there. So until next time, I'm Brett.
I'm Dan.
I'm Angela.
And we'll see you all again next time.
The creation wanders into the local square, trying to steal food before getting attacked by villagers. They think he has cholera. Frankenstein's creature uses his immense strength to kill the townspeople and protect himself while accidentally causing chaos. He jumps onto a wagon carrying corpses and escapes into the wilderness. Victor wakes in bed having survived a bad case of pneumonia. The cholera epidemic is getting worse. He stands and follows the sound of music into the room next door. Elizabeth sits at a piano. She stands, runs to Victor, and they kiss passionately.
There's this whole moment of the creature coming to life and getting away that should have sold so much better in this. And it leads to bigger problems later in the film. Victor brings the thing to life. They spend 20 minutes slipping around in the amniotic fluid on the floor with the creature being nude.
It's pretty long.
And it's
and I don't mean, I mean the moment, not.
And then in one of the most clumsy and disjointed ways, knocks the creature out while he's hoisting him up on these chains. For some reason, he thinks the creature's dead, so he's going to go lie in bed and pout about it. Then the creature comes to life, steals his shit, and runs off. And it's like a motivation for him later on to take revenge on Frankenstein. But Frankenstein didn't do much. He just went to bed. So
right.
What is the revenge about? What are we doing here?
That's what's a real struggle for the second half of this movie, is it's just hard to feel that the creature is deeply justified in his actions. There are parts in the scene that I like and parts of the scene that I don't. So I actually really like the part with the amniotic fluid when the creature comes out of the pod. I actually really like the fact that he slips and falls in. It's very sad. It's a little pathetic. Victor can't hold him up. He's too big. And so the creature just keeps falling everywhere. And then he falls into these chains that sort of wrap around him, and he accidentally gets pulled up into the ceiling and he hits his head along the way. I actually kind of like the chaos of it. I do feel a little sorry for the creature. And the thing that does not work in the second half of this film is that you just royally don't feel sorry for the creature. You don't feel a lot of sympathy for him. He definitely comes off more as the villain. And the parts where you're supposed to feel sympathy for him just come off as laughable. But I like this part right here, because obviously the birthing fluid is meant to feel like a birth. You know, that's meant to be what they're going for. But I totally agree with you on the part afterwards. When the creature gets pulled up to the ceiling by the chains, Victor literally, this is like unbelievable. He turns and looks into a mirror and he says to his reflection, "What have I done?"
Yeah.
And I'm like, Jesus Christ, like, what did they do to make this movie? Like, this is as if Kenneth Branagh hired the writing team for The Young and the Restless to make this movie.
I'll tell you, this is one of the few moments in our narrative through these two parts where I'm going to get really nerdy in particular about the novel. This is actually one of the turning points in the film that was supposed to sell it hard. Victor in the book took a look at the creature when it had come to life and found it so hideous that he couldn't even manage to be in the room with it. And he was like, "Oh, you're an abomination. You're a devil. You're this, you're that. And I can't believe what I've done." And he felt so morose about making this life and being so repulsed by it that he had to remove himself from it, which then the creature took personal, obviously. Like, nobody wants to be called ugly. And this is basically his father rejecting him and telling him he's worthless and ugly and horrible. So it sets up the revenge motivation. That played. That was well written. That was a good moment. It was strong. Storytelling. Wonderful. This was a whiny, steampunk emo bullshit wrapped in my own brain moment. And the thing is hanging up there. He doesn't know it's dead. He doesn't even know.
Right.
He's just looking up at it going, well, I fucked that up. He looks at his own reflection, go, God, I'm such a fucking loser. And then he goes to bed.
Well, and again, it's that moral shift that happens for no reason. You know, it's so brief. He literally, the guy can't get up. You know, the creature can't stand, falls in these chains, gets pulled to the roof. And then Victor says, what have I done? And what did Victor think was going to happen? Did he think that the creature was going to get out and like also do a Irish dance? Like, what did he think was going to happen?
If they had spent 3 minutes less of slipping around on the floor and 1 minute more of developing why he was so morally repulsed by this, it would have sold.
Or but
they didn't.
I like the whole thing with the fluid on the floor. So add 2 more minutes to the movie. Add 2 more minutes to the movie where we just get to know what repulses Victor or what makes him ask the moral question, which I don't even think you need. All you need is to have that scene with the fluid and the chains, and then you have to have the creature just escape. That's all that has to happen.
I don't mind them slipping around on the floor. I just wish it was a little shorter. It didn't have to go on as long as it did.
It's long.
Like, I think the scene was great.
Yeah.
But again, give Victor that repulsion, which then gives the creature motivation. You didn't do that. That was so important to this moment.
It gets into the weird timing of this movie too, because the creature steals a jacket and everything's like high drama. You know, the creature is chasing Kenneth Branagh's character around the room. Kenneth Branagh's throwing things at him, knocking over shelves. Then Victor runs and goes to get an axe and comes back. Now, I don't know if Victor took a long time to like pick his axe or pick the perfect one, because Victor runs away and then the creature runs over to the jacket, quickly puts it on, and then it shows this series of shots where he gingerly puts on a pair of shoes, like where he wraps his feet in cloth. And I'm like, just fucking run out. You're Frankenstein's creature. Just run outside. Like, why are we watching you try on cloth?
Meanwhile, he's basically the first flasher. He's got nothing on under that coat anyway. So
can you imagine he did not button up that jacket?
He's just flapping in the wind as he's running down the street.
Right. No wonder those villagers were terrified.
Some of them are looking at it like, well, Victor spared some expense. I don't know what's going on there.
I do want to talk about that scene in the town, square, because this is one of the few parts that is a big diversion from the novel. I actually really like it. So maybe I'm just connecting with my childhood, and I always loved action in movies. I was a horror movie guy, but I was also an action movie guy. And so this is one of the times where I think that they're trying to bring an action movie mentality to the film that works, in my opinion.
Sure.
So first of all, I think the creature, like, costume wise, I have some issue with the makeup, but costume wise, I think he looks great. I love the idea of that. He steals a watchman's cloak. And so it's black. It doesn't look like the old Frankenstein suit. And I think it looks really cool. But he goes and he has to have this kind of fight with the villagers that shows off how deadly he is. It shows off his strength. He's tipping carts over. He's throwing big chunks of wood. He's taking people and literally throwing them into the crowd. I actually really like this. I actually think it shows how deadly he is, and also it shows how rejected he was.
And it's the emotional state as well, which this is one of the few Frankenstein movies that actually took to the book's idea of him, where he could speak and he could rationalize and think and be a person, albeit fairly hideous and deformed and what have you. And he let his emotions run so that when he got to the crowd and people started freaking out and da-da-da, the only choice he had was to lash out. And I think that really gets us in the mind of the creature, which should have set him up for the sympathy and the care that we would have developed had we read the novel. But this film farted on that, basically, and didn't quite get us there.
So, Leo,
yes,
we've only covered the first half of the movie, and maybe there's a big redemption arc coming in the second half.
For you or me?
Who knows? But what did you think of the first half of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein?
I think it's tough. It's been a very long time since I've read the novel. I've only seen this movie the one viewing, or the three viewings now for this show. And it's a difficult movie to not compare to the film simply because they went so far out of their way, as I mentioned at the beginning of this, to make them as accurate as possible. This Frankenstein is much more, so far, about the doctor, more than the monster. And Brenna, his characterization of Victor is not terrible, but it's not what we want for the sympathetic person, per se. I know they tried. They tried so hard to be like, oh, poor Victor, oh, poor Victor. It wasn't for me as egregious as Rob Zombie's Halloween. and the poor little Michael Myers bullshit that they did in the front of that. Mm-hmm. But it was still, I don't know, it just didn't hit. It didn't capture me. It didn't hook me. It didn't bring me where I was supposed to go. And then they make the creature happen. And yeah, it was big and it was cinematic, but it wasn't exciting and it wasn't fulfilling. And I wasn't like, oh shit, here he comes. And you were supposed to be. And it didn't. I think that's the thing with the first half of this, if not the rest of it, is that it just isn't, it's going so far out of its way to tell you what emotions you're supposed to have, but it's not giving you what you need to get to those emotions. And that sucks.
This movie brought me somewhere that I did not intend to go. It did not bring me to a really interesting, horrific exchange of ideas about life and death in the area in between. It brought me back to having to deal with insufferable theater people.
Yes, exactly.
That's all I kept thinking about was I just was watching this and going, God, this is like watching a bad play. And I think that is very prevalent when you're watching this story. You know, Kenneth Branagh, I think he's talented. I think he's very talented. Mm-hmm. But you can see the folly of youth. And the need to make everything very dramatic. Again, I've seen his Hamlet, and his Hamlet has the same, like, it's better than this movie. It is better.
Sure. But came out after this, I assume.
But yes, I don't know that. I don't know that. I think Hamlet's just better suited to the material because you expect soliloquies, because you expect characters to just speak to no one, you know, or to the audience, and that's okay. That makes sense. Yeah. But the sword fights in that, like, I want you to think about how those sword fights look in a play versus look in the Kenneth Branagh Hamlet. They look, they look like the lab scene in this movie.
Yeah.
And they're cool. They're swashbuckling sword fights. It works a little bit better in that movie. But yeah, I mean, this film is just so overdramatic. It's just so filled with weird time lapses that are just going to get worse and just going to get more and more strange. Monologues where a lot happens within minutes, even seconds. It's just not a very good movie other than the fact that it has just a gorgeous set design. I almost imagine it was like when we covered Death by Temptation and we could see the work of like Ernest Dickerson behind the camera. And we were like, oh my God, like this movie is so rich and beautiful looking, but there is some green talent, even though quite frankly, I think Death by Temptation is about a 50 times better movie than this.
Isn't that weird?
I know. But that movie, just like Ernest Dickerson, you could see how much he brought to the film.
Yeah.
And you could see how much some of the talented actors brought to the film. I can't even say the actor part is true for this, because other than John Cleese, I think everybody is doing their best with very bad material. And actually, I don't even think Kenneth Branagh is doing all that great. And just to clue everybody in, there's a really bad performance coming down the line. A really bad performance coming down the line. So the set design is gorgeous, though. It really, really is. A more gothic and more fun Frankenstein, or one that was so bad that it was good, that was like a B-movie type, you know, with a Stilba type from, you know, Howling 2. That could work. That could have been fun. For sure. With this kind of level of, you know, labs and candles and bullshit. But otherwise, this is just a kind of a fucking ridiculous movie, and it does not go uphill from here. Let's just say that.
And I think that's the fair warning to the next part of this, because I agree with you. Compliments to the costume designer for the most part. Compliments to the set designer. Compliments to the actors for giving it their all in a very difficult situation. We have some strong talent in here. There's no question about it. And there's no reason with the names that you have in this film performing for you that things should have come out as bad as they did, other than it was just written poorly and they could only polish that turd so much and it's still a turd at the end, no matter how clean and shiny it is. I guess it's just that. It's a fair warning for part two, because I'm not going to shit all over this movie, but I'm not going to compliment it when it doesn't deserve it either. So,
well, let me end on a compliment that is deserved. Maybe we've called this out. Maybe we haven't. You know, sometimes when you're podcasting, you do a number of episodes. Sometimes you forget you said things. So I wanted to make sure that we gave a shout out to our friends over at Horror House, because a couple weeks ago we did an episode with them. We did give that a shout out in our Birds episode. But also I want to make sure that we recognize that they had their 100th episode. We've been recording, you know, a lot recently, and so I just didn't want to. I was like, did we mention that in the Silence of the Lambs? I hope we did, but I wanted to mention now.
We definitely did. I just feel like let's do it again anyway, because they're right. Fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And 100 episodes, as we found out, is not easy to attain.
Ugh.
It's not it's not easy to get to. It's a feat that's worth celebrating, and goddamn it, you guys did it, so fucking celebrate.
A part of me died on the inside at the beginning of this episode when I said 122.
I know, right?
Like, Jesus Christ.
We're actually on the road to 200 inevitably, and that's a hell of a thing.
I know. Crazy. Yeah, we're going to get there first, Horror House. Remember that. Just remember who your elders are.
Take that, you whippersnapper. When I started podcasting, all we had was a toothpick that reverberated when we spoke into it. We had two cans and a string. That was it.
Anyway, this was not supposed to be about us. You guys have a great show. I'm glad we're complimenting you twice.
Yeah, you guys are awesome. Thank you for being friends and having us part of it and all of that. So, yay. Yay you. Yay.
All right, everybody. Well, we will see you next week for Mary Shelley's Frankenstein Part 2.
Bye.